This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are one of the greatest songwriting teams of the second half of the 20th century, Burt Bacharach and Hal David. Evidence of their greatness includes the songs Make It Easy on Yourself, I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself, Only Love Can Break a Heart, Don't Make Me Over, Anyone Who Had a Heart, Wishin' and Hopin'. There's always something there to remind me. What the world needs now is love and the look of love. Dionne Warwick had 38 singles written by Bacharach and David that made the charts. This one's from 1964.
If you see me walking down the street and I start to cry each time we meet, walk on by. Just let me grieve in private, 'cause each time I see you, I break down and cry. Walk on by.
Don't stop.
Walk on by.
Don't stop.
Walk on by. I just can't get over you.
I've interviewed Burt Bacharach and Hal David separately, but I never thought I'd have the chance to talk to them together. But the revival of their 1968 Broadway show Promises, Promises has given me that opportunity. It's the only Broadway musical they've done. Two songs from it became hits, the title song and I Say a Little Prayer. Neil Simon wrote the book for the show, adapting it from the Billy Wilder movie The Apartment. The revival stars Sean Hayes and Kristen Chenoweth. Burt Bacharach, Hal David, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, it's such an honor to talk with you together. I was always hoping for a chance this would happen, and I'm grateful that that it has. Let's talk about some of the songs you wrote for the show. Let's start with the title song, Promises, Promises, which Jerry Orbach sang in the original production. So let's start by hearing his performance of Promises, Promises. So here we go.
Promises, I'm all through with promises, promises now. I don't know how I got the nerve to walk out. If I shout, remember, I feel free. Now I can look at myself and be proud. I'm laughing out loud. Oh, promises, promises, this is where those promises, promises end. I won't pretend that what was wrong can be right. Every night I'll sleep now, no more lies. Things that I promised myself fell apart, but I found my heart. Oh, promises, they're kind of promises, take all the joy from promises can just destroy your life. Oh, promises, promises, my kind of promises can lead to joy and hope and love. Yes, love.
That's Jerry Orbach in the original cast recording of Promises, Promises. Burt Bacharach, Hal David, let's talk about how you wrote the song. Let's start with the title. Hal David, did the title Promises, Promises start with the song or with the show?
I think it started with David Merrick, who wanted a title song for the show.
And was the show already called Promises, Promises?
Yeah, and I think Neil wanted to call it Promises, Promises.
Yeah.
And not The Apartment. That was the source from the original film, the Billy Wilder film. And it was just kind of nice to hear Jerry Orbach singing there.
Yeah.
Because I guess I hadn't heard that cast album in
40 years.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, Hal. I don't sit around listening to.
No, I don't either.
Our old cast album. But Jerry Orbach, he was wonderful in the show. I mean, as Sean Hayes is just magnificent in the show. But I remember with Jerry Orbach coming into New York, when I came into New York, and would come to see the show maybe after I'd been playing 3 months, and I'd go backstage and see the cast. And Jerry Orbach would say to me, "Man, if I had to sing this song again, one more." Yeah, because it's granted, it is a very notey. In other words, it's not an easy song to sing. My motivation was the urgency that makes it work dramatically, or you think it's going to work dramatically, by the anger that comes through. And it needed that many notes and that many words. But Jerry, after 3 months, was saying, "Why do you have to make it so difficult?" Night after night, he's up there doing Promises, bro.
So, Burt Bacharach, you said it's so notey because it has to show anger. Well, the instruments, the orchestra is kind of like churning behind behind the singer. Yeah. And it's just like there's such a kind of hyperactive energy going on there. And the time signature keeps changing. It changes like 20 right. times during the song. So it's just kind of like frenetic sounding and disorienting in a way. It's wonderful. Did you consciously say when you sat down to write the song, it needs 20 different key changes, signature changes?
No, I never do. I've never done anything like intentionally. It's only when I have gotten it where I'm hearing it, where it's in my head, where I can play it, where I can get away from it, lie on the couch, go over my head, and I start to write it down. And when I write it out, I realize, hey, that's change. You've got to change time signature in this bar, time signature in this bar. So it's not deliberate. I mean, that's the main thing. It can drive musicians crazy, you know, until they stop counting and just hear and feel the music. And I think it's kind of selfish on my part. I just write it, say, we got to get it done. You know, it'll get done. So as far as your observation about the churning and the orchestra, yeah. So much of what I've written, whether it's from the show or whenever, it's always been, it's almost like they come out of the same bed, you know? It's not just piano and voice. It's like where the drums will be playing, where the strings come in, where they are. Yeah. They are made and created about the same time as the song is being written.
So you hear that all in your head as you're writing the song. You hear the percussion, you hear the trumpet.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Well, that leads me to the final version I want to play of Promises, Promises, and that's the one that was the really big hit, Dionne Warwick's version. Did you know at the start that you would ask her to do this song? She had already had hits with some of your songs.
Well, she was like our star vehicle, you know. I mean, we had been recording Dionne and producing her, kind of trying to tailor-make songs that would fit her, and she was an extraordinary vocalist and a great vehicle for what we would write. And the more that we would write for Dionne, the more we would see where we could go with her, the challenges that we could do.
Dionne is a great musician.
Yeah.
Has a great feel for the songs we wrote.
And also how, you know, by having that kind of mobility, I mean, you take a song like Promises, Promises, in somebody else's hands, it could sound maybe labored or under duress being sung. Dionne just kind of floated through it, like effortlessly. And that was one of the things that she had.
She's incredible. Let's hear her recording of Promises, Promises.
Can be right every
But our promises can just destroy our lives.
One of the things I like about that recording, it's so vivid. And I just love all the orchestral things going on in the background. And, like, is it kettle drum or timpani that you're using?
Yeah, timpani? Orchestra bells, yeah.
I just love hearing all of that. So that's all on your mind as you're writing the song. And I think it's actually more vivid on the Dionne Warwick recording than in the Broadway cast recording.
Well, it's also slower. That surprised me
when
you started to play it. I said, wow.
Yeah.
Wow, I must have taken a slow pill or something before we record that. But I think also I was thinking probably how we were thinking, like commercially, would be the easier one to grasp would be maybe at a little more slow, measured tempo.
Well, whatever it was, it is slower, no question about it. But she is smooth, and yet she's got all the music and all the lines in the songs. She's really telling it to us.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the other really big hit from the show, I'll Never Fall in Love Again. There's a great story behind the song. So whichever one of you wants to start telling it, go ahead.
Well, when Bert was hospitalized with pneumonia.
It was like maybe 3 days after we opened in Boston, too. And we had good reviews in Boston.
Yeah.
We thought we had a hit.
We thought we had a hit, but there was one spot in the show. We had a song called Wouldn't That Be a Stroke of Luck or something similar to that.
Yeah.
And
that's a good title, Hal.
Yeah. But we threw it out. That song didn't work. Everybody liked the song, but the audience didn't like the song. And while Bert was in the hospital, I started writing lyrics for that song. You know, the famous lines, what do you get when you kiss a girl? You get enough germs to catch pneumonia after you do. She'll never phone you. I don't recall thinking that Bert was in the hospital and had pneumonia, but obviously there was some subconscious thing about it because that's what I wrote.
So
we wrote it really quickly.
I mean, I think you wrote it. I gave you a lot of the lyric. I think we wrote it in one day.
The day I got out of the hospital.
The day you got out of the hospital. We played it for Neil and David Merrick, they wanted it in the show the next day. It stopped the show. Like a Hollywood movie, it just stopped the show.
As it did the other night when the opening of the revival. Yeah.
So, Burt Bacharach, you must have been feeling pretty lousy when you wrote this song, if you'd just gotten out of the hospital from pneumonia.
Yeah, I felt there's no way to recover from pneumonia is to then write the song and then start standing in the back of the house, meaning in the back of the theater in Boston for the rest of the run, and then going on to Washington and doing the same and being in a sweat and thinking you had the pneumonia back and getting frustrated with the conductor that we had, the tempos, and, you know, I'm kind of a control freak, so what was my choice? Go and take the place of the conductor and spend the next 3 years of my life in the pit, in the Broadway pit, conducting. But it's not the way to get over pneumonia.
I bet it's not. But I can understand your frustration. I mean, your songs are so tricky and require, I think, a real sense of precision to really get all the twists and turns in the rhythm and in the orchestrations. And you must
and
have really and the tempos, and you must have really wanted to be there conducting.
Well, yes, but that is not the answer because then you put the rest of your life and your career on a hold.
Right,
you know?
Right. Okay, so we have to hear the song now. So this is I'll Never Fall in Love Again, a.k.a. the pneumonia song. And why don't we hear Dionne Warwick singing it? That's I'll Never Fall in Love Again, one of the hit songs from the Broadway show Promises, Promises, which is now being revived on Broadway. My guests are the song's composers, the famous songwriting team of Burt Bacharach and Hal David. So, you know, we were talking before about time signature changes, and there aren't a lot of them in I'll Never Fall in Love Again, but their song, I think, is really significant. It switches from 4/4 time to 2/4 time on the all of
Very
I'll Never
good.
Fall in Love Again. Just like one note, I'll Never Fall in Love Again.
Yeah. Very good observation.
So what does it do to change just for that one note from to the I'll
Never Fall in Love Again? It makes it fresher for me, and it's a nice little turn. And it always surprised me with one of the first records we got on it, Ella Fitzgerald. Ella,
great record.
Except...
She didn't do it then.
She didn't
square
it out. I'll never fall in love again.
And that
but
bothers
that,
you.
that record was on its way to being a hit, and then Dion's came out, and of course,
yeah,
Dion just swamped her.
It's true, but I like it with a 6/4 bar mm-hmm. or 4/4, 2/4, as you say.
Yeah. Well, what I like about that is I think it frames the all. Like everything kind of stops for a second when it's sung. That way. But a lot of singers don't do it. A lot of singers just go like, I'll never fall in love again. You know, they don't emphasize. They don't give it the full two beats on the aisle. And it always frustrates me.
Well, they go to the most normal way, but an abnormal way can, in its own right, be the right way. And, you know, can be natural. Just like the easier way out would have been to just not change bar lines, not going 4/4, 2/4. But hey, we didn't do it that way. It didn't hurt us.
Did so
fine.
What did it mean to you in 1968 to have a Broadway show, to be on Broadway? Was that important to you?
Well, it was important to me. And I think it was the most fun time I had on any project I've done. I don't know if Bert will feel the same way, but...
If I hadn't gotten sick, I would have had a good time. You know, by the time we did the cast album, I was just looking to get to Palm Springs and not touch a piano for a while. So we should have written another one, but should have and would have and could have. We don't count that out.
Were you asked?
You did enough.
I don't know that we were asked. I just know that I had some frustration, too, that came from the actual parameters of writing something for the theater, and that was there are substitutes in the orchestra. Maybe there are 2-3 subs in a given performance. My music is not so easy to play. And I remember getting a call from David Merrick.
The producer of the show. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, a week and a half into the show. And he called me up and said, I want you to know that there were 5 subs in the band today. It was a Saturday matinee. Five members of the band had subs. The drummer, first trumpet player. These are key people reading the music for the first time. And Richard Rodgers was in the house.
Oh.
And I say, geez, you know what I mean? You just want to kind of go and stick your head in the sand in the desert. Because you want him to hear it at the best.
You must have really preferred the recording studio in that respect, where you could really control every
aspect.
Then
he had permanence.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But there's something electric about a live performance. You know?
Tell us how you met.
Oh, we were both at Famous Music.
Oh, in the Brill Building. I mean, just like working the floors.
Yeah. And everybody was writing with everybody.
Yeah.
And one day we said, let's try to write a couple of songs together. One of us said that to me.
Well, we wrote some bad songs to start.
Yeah.
We wrote
really?
Some really bad.
Like what?
Peggy's in the Pantry.
Peggy's in the Pantry?
Yeah.
Does somebody want to sing that?
But
Underneath the Overpass, you remember that? Huh?
Yeah, that was Joe Stafford.
Yeah. At least we got a record on it, you know what I mean?
But we also did Magic Moments, which...
It took us a while to get a hit. I mean, it really did. Magic Moments, the story of my life. But,
I think of that as happening very early on.
So how did you get a sense that you should collaborate with each other? I mean, what did you know about each other's work? What attracted you to each other musically?
Well, Hal had been doing it longer than me and kind of successfully had hits. And, you know, it was an interesting time in the Brill Building, the famous Brill Building. There were seven floors of music publishers. Okay. Yeah, well, you could go and play a song for one publisher and then he'd say, I don't like it. And then you go down the hall and play it for another. And that in itself was a very interesting time.
You wrote so many hits together. At what point did you break up, and why did you stop writing together?
Well, it's a long story.
Yeah.
I think we got involved with a motion picture that probably never should have been made. Making a motion picture, a movie musical, with new songs, it's not like you can go to Boston and try it out. The film is shot. And the idea that you can replace a song and reshoot the scene and the sequence. The picture was called Lost Horizon, and it presented its own set of problems. And I must say that I wrote the score, the background score, as well as writing the songs with Hal. Songs sounded good. I mean, they still sound good to me.
The score, I think, is a very good piece of work. But the movie just didn't work.
I mean, there's a song in the middle of the movie called If I Could Go Back, that Peter Finch's character sings. And it's about his longing, whether he stays in Shangri-La or goes back to England. He has a chance to do either one. Stay in Shangri-La and you live forever. And when we made the record, made that particular song for the soundtrack, it sounded great. I mean, I thought, Jesus, it's beautiful. And then when you see it in the movie, you're sitting there. You don't care whether he goes back or stays. It doesn't make any difference. You don't care about him. So
the film was bad. The songs were good. How did that break up your relationship?
I didn't want to write anymore, period.
Really? It was. You were that discouraged from that movie?
Oh, listen, I drove up to the opening night. A theater, having just read the LA Times review, and I just want to get out of town. I want to go down to Del Mar and at a little beach house there and hide, you know, and not write and just play tennis every day. And even though my attorney told me, hey, you know, you're going to get in trouble with your commitment with Hal to write for Dion. She's going on Warner Brothers now, new label. New album is expected to come out. And I just ignored his advice very bad. So, you know, as far as responsibility and blame, it's all on me, you know.
Well, whatever it was, we've been friends ever since.
Yeah, it was just, you know, I'm very happy to own that up, Hal. You know, we should have just, again, should have, could have sat down and just said, let's write some new stuff for Dion's album. But, hey, man, I don't want to write with anybody. You or anybody.
Hal David, did you want to give up songwriting after the movie got such bad reviews and realized
how bad
it was?
I could understand why someone would, but no, I didn't. I kept writing.
So I thought we could close with another song. And this is a song that you wrote that you didn't write for Promises, Promises, but it's been interpolated into the new production. And the song is I Say a Little Prayer. And I thought we'd use Aretha Franklin's 1968 recording of it.
Great record.
Yeah. Were you amazed to hear her record this?
It's a better record than the record we made.
We did, yeah. I mean, we did a great record, but she topped it.
Oh, yeah.
Why is this one better?
Well, you'll hear it.
It's more natural. It's just more natural. We're talking about Bart changes, time change, on the chorus, forever, forever, stay in my heart. And I, you know, that's going 4-4-3-4-4-4-3-4. Then regard the way it was treated by Aretha, because Aretha just makes it seamless, the transition going from one change to another change. You never notice it.
Okay. It's been really an honor to speak with you both. Thank you so much for doing this.
Hey, good talking to you.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little prayer for you. And while combing my hair now, and wondering what dress to wear now, I say a little prayer for you.
I spoke with Burt Bacharach and Hal David last week. A revival of their musical Promises, Promises is now on Broadway, starring Sean Hayes and Kristen Chenoweth. You probably know pack rats, people who tend to store things they might need someday. And you've probably come across someone whose home is so cluttered, you can't imagine how they live there. Our guests Randy Frost and Gail Stedeke are both specialists in obsessive behavior. And they say compulsive hoarding, the pathological accumulation of things, is shockingly common. Estimates vary, but they say the disorder likely affects roughly one out of every 30 Americans. Many lead miserably unhappy lives because of their compulsion, but find it nearly impossible to control. Randy Frost is a professor of psychology at Smith College. Gail Stedeke is a professor and dean of the School of Social Work at Boston University. Both have treated many hoarders, and they draw on their work in a new book called Stuff, Compulsive Hoarders and the Meaning of Things. They spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Randy Frost and Gail Stedeke, welcome to Fresh Air. We typically think of people with this problem as being introverted, maybe to the point of being shut in, perhaps a little disheveled, not somebody with a lot of friends, contacts. But you found this is not the case, at least often not the case. And one of the first people that you write about in the book is a woman named Irene. Tell us about her.
Well, Irene was a delightful woman. She, when I first met her, what happened was that her husband had told her that she needed to clean up the clutter or he would leave. And she couldn't do it, so he actually left. When I met her, I was surprised by how outgoing and lovely and a woman she was, with a great sense of humor. And so we've done some follow-up research on this and found that people with hoarding problems don't seem to have any more emotional attachment kinds of problems than other people.
What did the clutter in her house look like? What kinds of things were there? How high were they stacked? How much of the rooms did they occupy?
Well, it occupied virtually every room in her house except for her bathroom. And the bathrooms sort of vary from person to person with hoarding problems. But her bathrooms were pretty much the same as any bathroom you would see in most people's homes. The rest of her house was somewhere between knee-deep and head-deep in clutter, with goat paths going through each of the rooms.
When you say goat paths, you mean literally a narrow passageway that one
exactly.
could traverse and clutter everywhere else.
Exactly.
And what kind of stuff was there?
Well, it was virtually everything. Lots of newspapers, lots of clothes. Irene kept toys that her children had, broken toys that her children had. She had this box that she called her amazing junk. And it was little pieces of games and little pieces of plastic and little things that came in McDonald's meals and things of that sort.
she collected toys, things like that. What, newspapers? A lot of hoarders collect newspapers, don't they?
A lot. One of the motivations that seems key in people with hoarding is to maintain information. And we think it's related to a sense of wanting to acquire and preserve opportunities. So for Irene, when she looked at a newspaper, she saw lots of potential opportunities. And this carried over in a number of spheres. One was her difficulties with acquiring things. She told me that she couldn't go to New York City because if she goes to New York City, she walks by a newsstand. And when she sees a newsstand, she thinks to herself, look at all those newspapers and all those magazines. Somewhere in all that, there's a piece of information that could change my life. How can I walk away without it?
Now, it's interesting. When you interviewed hoarders, I mean, it seemed there were so many cases where apartments were so cluttered that they were virtually unlivable. And I'm curious, did the hoarders realize what their circumstances were like? If you showed them a picture of their home or apartment, would they recognize it?
Dave, it's interesting because there's a phenomenon that we refer to as clutter blindness. And I think in Stuff we mentioned that Nell had this problem. And what's interesting in particular is that when you do take pictures and show them the pictures later, they often seem to have the impression that it's shocked. It's like somebody else's home that they're looking at in the photograph, because to them that's not what it looks like when they walk into the house.
And if you ask them to draw a map of their house, what do you get?
One of the interesting experiences that we had early on was asking someone to do just that, to draw on paper a layout of the house. And the person actually left off two of the rooms of the home because they were so full that he hadn't been into them in a long time. And so they just disappeared from his point of view.
So they live in these little narrow passageways and in effect are what, oblivious to the clutter or comforted by it?
Well, interestingly, when I showed up at Nell's house, what she said to me was, you know, when you are here, I notice the clutter. And it makes me feel awful. I get depressed. I look at myself as a horrible person. But when you leave, I don't notice it anymore. And that is something that a number of the folks that we've talked to have told us about their hoarding.
Now, I'm sure a lot of people are listening to this and thinking about their own basements and attics and closets and wondering, do I have a problem? How do you know when this becomes a pathology?
When it crosses the line from, shall we just say, being a pack rat or collecting things, to the point where there's distress either on the part of the person who's got the problem or those around them, so distress on either side, and impairment when they can't do the things that they would like to do in their ordinary lives, when they can't socialize or have people into the house or work effectively, and on and on.
One of the interesting things, questions that we get all the time from people is what's the difference between someone who has a hoarding problem and someone who is a collector? When people collect things, they typically want to display them to other people. And in many ways, if you link this even broader to a broader notion of materialism, that's a part of the construct of materialism where people want to present a facade to the world with the objects that they have. But people who hoard are not like that. They don't want other people to see it. They want to kind of keep these things hidden because of the shame they feel when people see their homes.
Let's talk just a little about why people collect stuff. And you have a number of these patients that you've worked with that you've given pseudonyms to, and maybe they collect for different reasons. But do they get pleasure from the things that they collect that make their lives unworkable?
Absolutely. It's one of the most fascinating things about this is to see someone with a hoarding problem while they're getting pleasure from the object. A couple of examples. Once when I visited Irene, we started talking, and all of a sudden her eyes lit up, and she got very excited, and she said, I've got to show you something, and she ran off into the other room. And she came back a minute later with a large plastic bag filled with bottle caps. And she said, look at these bottle caps. Aren't they beautiful? Look at the shape and the color. in her eyes was such delight, such an appreciation for the aesthetics of these objects. And it's something we've seen in many people with hoarding problems, is this sort of aesthetic appreciation of the physical world that most of us don't have.
Now, in that case, the bottle caps have no particular connection to their lives or people that were important to them. They're absorbed with their physical characteristics. But you also find that there are some people that associate their objects with parts of their lives, become, in effect, representations of who they are, right?
That's right. And we find that in the same people. So on the one hand, Irene collected all these things because of this aesthetic appreciation. On the other hand, she collected a lot of the things that she had because of their sentimental attachment. And the attachment went well beyond what most of us have when we are sentimentally attached to an object. For instance, one day as we were going through some of her stuff, she came upon an ATM envelope that she'd gotten 5 years before, some money in it. And she had written on the envelope what she used the money for. And it wasn't anything all that special. And she put it in the box for recycling, and she started to cry. And what she said was, I feel like I'm losing that day in my life. So there's something about that object that seemed to represent that day of her life, and if she got rid of it, she would feel like somehow a part of her was now gone.
So this is fascinating. You have some people who collect newspapers because there might be something in the newspaper that might be helpful to them, and they'll save it for years. You have some people who collect things as insignificant as bottle caps because they're fascinated with their physical characteristics. And then you have some people who will keep an ordinary object because they feel a connection to an event or a person. It sounds like there are all kinds of different reasons that people pile this stuff up. Is there a connection that links them all?
These beliefs seem to be associated with some peculiar information processing problems. That is, there are some problems with attention, that is, distractibility, and sometimes a hyperfocus. Problems with categorization, the ability to organize things. People who hoard tend to live their lives visually and spatially instead of categorically like the rest of us do. So if Irene has an electricity bill, she puts it on top of the pile, and to find it, she remembers where it is in space, rather than putting it in a file somewhere under the category of bills. And the kind of emotional attachments and beliefs about possessions that we see are paired with this kind of information processing problem. That's when we seem to get the problem with hoarding.
Let's talk about treatment, because you know a lot about this because you've done a lot of this, helping folks who have come to you. Often, and sometimes family members will come to you because they're deeply affected by someone's hoarding problem, and people decide to get help. One of the things you tell us is that you don't want to throw things out for the hoarder. In other words, go in while they're not there and just toss stuff out. Why?
When people go into someone's home and clear it out, what happens is that they may change the condition of the home relatively quickly, but they don't change the person's behavior. And the behavior is really the problem. With that, without changing the behavior, the condition of the home will go back to what it was in short order. We've seen that time and again when health departments go in and clear people out. What we need to do is we need to get the person themselves to change their decision-making about what objects to keep and what objects to throw away. And that's why we focus so heavily on it.
And what's the emotional impact when a hoarder finds that someone has come in and gone through their stuff and thrown some of it out?
Typically quite disastrous, unfortunately. And it's a cautionary note, I think, not only to the community officers or agencies that are trying to do this, but also sometimes to family members who want to do it. It is a very quick way to destroy a relationship, because if you remember how people feel about these things, it's like ripping something away from them that they care greatly about. It's a disastrous experience for them. So anything we could do to make that a gentler process would be extremely helpful.
So what does work? How do you treat people like this?
One of the first things we start off with doing is trying to figure out how motivated they are to get over the problem. Because one of the things we mentioned several times in stuff is the relatively limited insight You know, when they're with us, they feel embarrassed. But in their own home, they're not at all sure they want to get rid of anything. So part of that is helping them figure out what values they have for the future and what goals they have based on those values. And that can help us sort of set the stage for when they want to back out or they're afraid to get rid of something, we can always double back to those goals. That's one place we start.
How do you get them to stop bringing the stuff in and accumulating it?
That's dealing with the acquiring problem, which is a very interesting challenge in and of itself. A little bit ago, we mentioned the fact that people get very excited about their objects, like the bottle caps, and that actually happens a great deal when people are getting new things, either free things or they're going to the store and looking at things they want to buy. They get very, very excited about them. And so part of the challenge there is a little like dealing with an addiction. Hoarding in many ways has elements of addictions like gambling and so forth, where the excitement drives the behavior. It's like a high that people get very stuck on, and it's hard to get over. So we have to help them go into situations. We call them often non-shopping trips that we engage in that help them get over the urge. It actually gradually gets less and less with more and more exposure.
It's a little bit like a physical conditioning program, except what we're conditioning is a tolerance for the urge to acquire something.
You know, people who've struggled with alcohol and who have been sober for years will not describe themselves as a former alcoholic. They think it's a condition they will always live with. Is the same true of hoarders?
One of the people in the book, Paula Kotakis, one of the few people who actually, not only did she give us permission to use our name, she said, if you're going to talk about me, please use my name because I want to be out there. I want to be someone who's upfront about hoarding as a problem and so forth. I asked her if we could describe her in the book as a former hoarder. And she wrote back and said no, because she struggles with it every day. And she wrote a description of her experience just a few days earlier where she was trying to throw out a used yogurt cup. And she described the thoughts that she had that somehow this yogurt cup, when she threw it in the trash bin, would be uncomfortable. And the yogurt cup would feel bad for being the one that got rejected, the one that got thrown away. And it would feel uncomfortable, extra humid because she put the lid on. And she's thinking, maybe I shouldn't have put the lid on. And then she thinks to herself, these thoughts are crazy. Why am I having these thoughts? But yet she can't ignore them.
I mean, that letter that she wrote about the yogurt cup was a very compelling thing to read in the book. A lot of people would hear that behavior and say, no, this is delusional. Are many hoarders like this?
Quite a few are, and we think there might be a distinction between people with what we consider hoarding disorder and people who have OCD hoarding, that is, hoarding that's due to obsessive-compulsive disorder, secondary obsessive-compulsive disorder. Now, the thoughts sound delusional, but the fact is that she knew the thoughts were crazy. Now, in delusional thinking, people don't know the thoughts are crazy, but she knew that these thoughts were crazy, but she couldn't stop them.
Well, Randy Frost, Gail Steckety, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dave.
Randy Frost and Gail Steckety are the authors of the new book, Stuff, Compulsive Hoarders and the Meaning of Things. They spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. You can see an animated dramatization of the way hoarders gather possessions on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also read the first chapter of Stuff. Also on our website, we have something interesting related to our first interview, a demo recording of the song Promises, Promises, featuring the composer Burt Bacharach on piano, accompanying two singers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for digital media. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.